of good old Boston, where the Lowells talk to the Cabots, and the Cabots talk only to God. Mary's and Natalie's relatives sip tea in the same New England drawing rooms, and Mary's parents' home on Mount Vernon Street was frequented by many of the same contemporary luminaries found at Natalie's Uncle George Curtis's home, notably Ralph Waldo Emerson. In New Mexico, however, the class boundaries that defined the society of old Boston blurred and even dissolved. Mary still had the financial resources and freedom from economic concerns that Carol could only dream about. But Carol had the experience, contacts, and equipment that Mary needed to negotiate the frontier of the Southwest. Mary's new life in New Mexico began when she was 40, precipitated by the death of her widowed mother, Sarah Perkins Cabot. Born a year before Carol, in 1878, Mary did not attend college, but in keeping with the custom of New England's upper classes, was educated at home by tutors and governesses. As a young woman, tall, angular, aristocratic Mary was awkward and opinionated, intelligent, curious, and a nonconformist. The decidedly unfeminine Mary, for all her wealth and position, never attracted suitors or married. By middle age and her journey to the Southwest, she was a sheltered but powerful spinster. She was an entity, one of her relatives remembered. You knew when you were talking with Mary that she was somebody. By the time of her mother's death in 1917, Mary was ready to experience life beyond her parents' Beacon Hill palace. Once released from her life sentence as the dutiful unmarried daughter who cared for her parents, Mary woke up and began to travel the world in search of intellectual stimulation, spiritual inspiration, and personal renewal. She was blessed with an abundance of family money, but she also inherited the Cabot's practical, fiercely independent character, and a strong interest in nature, and a need to get away from civilization. By 1920, middle-aged Mary was increasingly preoccupied with a personal study of the myths and symbols of the world's great religions. After exploring the mystical and spiritual traditions of Europe, Greece, and Egypt, she turned her attention to the world of Native America found in Arizona and New Mexico. Mary and a traveling companion, Katie Scott, had come to New Mexico just after Mary's mother died in 1918 and stayed on the Pajarito with Carol at the Rancho Ramon Vigil. Returning after her travels overseas, she immersed herself in the emancipated society of women and men gathering in and around Santa Fe. Mary especially appreciated the bohemian culture of Santa Fe, where material wealth was not the measure of a person's worth. It was exciting to come to a region where individuals counted so much, coming as I had from a community where family customs and possessions made a great deal of difference. At San Gabriel Ranch, Mary unpacked her trunks and set up her headquarters from which to explore the Southwest. San Gabriel and its owners gave Mary a wonderful introduction to the country, with Roy giving the guests an atmosphere of casual adventure, and his Choke from Massachusetts wife, the musical, imaginative, and adventuresome Carol, bringing the appreciation of a cultivated woman to the imaginative quality of the Indian and Spanish life of the region. The village of Alcalde was, in Mary's opinion, a very primitive place, where the Spanish-speaking residents still adhered to the traditions, customs, and superstitions of their forefathers, and where daily conversations frequently included stories of brujas, witches, and supernatural goings-on. The villagers were devout Catholics, and the penitente morada on the village plaza, literally over the wall from San Gabriel Ranch's main office, was close enough that guests could hear and observe the clandestine activities of the hermanos. The Fafels had a good relationship with their Spanish neighbors, and in exchange for the Fafels' silence about the activities of the alcalde hermanos, the villagers allowed Carol, Roy, and their wide-eyed San Gabriel guests, including Mary, to huddle in the shadows and observe the procession at Lent of the primitive penitente death cart. Mary was fascinated by the traditions and old-world culture of Spanish New Mexico, but it was the world of the American Indians that especially captured her imagination. The mysticism and ceremonies of the Navajo were of particular personal interest to Mary and her quest to understand her place in the world. In Indian rituals, Mary, like one of her favorite writers, D.H. Lawrence, hoped to find freedom from two of the curses of civilization, loneliness and boredom. In the symbols and myths of the American Indians, Mary saw commonalities with other world religions she had studied in her travels, especially those found in the East Indies. I remember quite well when this idea came to me, of religion as a great tide which moved men all around the world. It gave me a feeling of peace and took away much of the feeling of loneliness from my life. During her stay at San Gabriel in 1920, Mary heard the details of Carol's arrival in the Southwest 5 years before, and of her several months' stay with the Wetherills at Kayenta, at the time one of the wildest and most lawless parts of the West. Carol's stories of her expeditions through Indian country stirred Mary's desire to experience for herself the untouched wilderness, where Carol had met untamed Indians and witnessed private Ute, Hopi, and Navajo ceremonies. I began to hear from Mrs. Pfaffel and others about the Navajo religion, the ceremonies they had, Mary wrote. Finally, Mrs. Pfaffel and Miss Evelyn Sears and I went on a trip to try and get in touch with some of this life. With San Gabriel's premier auto wrangler and guide, Orville Cox, Mary went to Gallup for the annual Navajo ceremonial. During this event, where hundreds of Navajos came to dance and trade, and hundreds of tourists came to buy Navajo rugs and jewelry, Mary purchased a remarkable, one-of-a-kind ceremonial tapestry woven by the legendary Navajo medicine man, Hosteen Klaw. Klaw was perhaps the most influential cacique on the Navajo reservation, the first Navajo man to become a master weaver, and the very first Navajo, male or female, to weave sacred Yabachai sand-painting designs into a tapestry. Following the devastation brought to the Navajos by the flu epidemic of 1919 to 1920, the 53-year-old Klaw worried about the preservation of Diné ceremonials and chants. Among the Navajo, nothing was ever recorded or written down, and the details of all songs, chants, and ceremonies were orally passed from medicine man to apprentice. Although he had a young apprentice, Bial Bael, Klaw realized that recording his sacred sand paintings, traditionally destroyed after use, in woven tapestries, would tangibly preserve valuable knowledge of the Navajo way for future generations. Even though Klaw's intention was to save the spiritual traditions of his people, his first Yabachai weaving, the whirling log painting, caused so much distress among the Navajos, who feared the rendition of a sacred sand painting in permanent form would bring disaster to the tribe, that Klaw's gigantic 12-by-12-foot outdoor loom had to be guarded at night. The Hail Chant tapestry that Mary bought in late summer of 1920 and its medicine man creator were Mary's gateway into the world of Navajo symbolism and mysticism. Mary returned from Gallup to San Gabriel and asked Carol to arrange an excursion into the outback so that she could witness the authentic Navajo ceremonials and perhaps locate and talk with Hosteen Klaw. Carol had met Klaw during her travels through Navajo land with Louisa Wetherill, and she knew the best way to locate the famous cacique and the ceremonies taking place on the reservation was to contact Arthur and Frank Newcomb, traders at Nava, south of Shiprock. After making arrangements to stay in one of the Newcomb's guest cottages, and with confirmation of at least one Navajo ceremony being held near Canyon de Chelly, Carol and her driver, Orville Cox, went into Indian country with Mary and her friend, Evelyn Sears. Like Carol, Mary was raised near the sea in a family of sailors, and the immense unpeopled expanses of the desert was strangely similar to those found on the open ocean. Mary was an experienced sailor, and Indian country's nearly featureless landscape, edged by the wavering line of an unreachable horizon, was an environment in which she was comfortable. My particular release and joy in the East was sailing and cruising on the sea in the summer, and when I came to the desert, I found it gave me a similar feeling of vastness and escape, and I came to love that, too. The auto route from Alcalde to Chinle and Canyon de Chelly eventually became nothing more than rutted tracks. Carol had made arrangements for them to stay overnight at Cozy McSparren's trading post, but when they arrived at Canyon de Chelly, they learned there was a Tulegi or night chant ceremony taking place that very night at another location in the desert. Although they had traveled all day and it was already dark, Orville gassed up the Lincoln and, with the three women, headed out into the night to find the Navajo camp. Carol and Orville managed to find the ceremony as much by the chanting and singing, which Mary thought sounded very much like coyotes, as by the fires and smoke of the Indian camp. Mary Carroll, Evelyn Sears, and Orville stood and watched the dancers through a pall of smoke so thick it was like a tent. With their eyes smarting from acrid smoke and tears running down their cheeks, they climbed back into the Lincoln and drove over the Chaska Mountains. It began to snow, and by dawn, when they reached the trading post at Crystal, New Mexico, they were negotiating a blizzard. The guest quarters at the post were filled with storm-stranded travelers, and the three women slept on the floor of the unheated lumber room. From Crystal, they drove 20 miles northeast on a road that was nothing but a track going up and down and across all the arroyos, to Nava and the Newcomb's trading post. The weather had turned bitter cold, and it continued to snow. While the car bumped and slipped across the rough terrain at the foot of the Chaska Mountains, Mary saw a thing I have never understood to this day. A solitary man on horseback, pursued by an eagle. Like the Hopis, the Navajos captured eagles and used their feathers in sacred ceremonies. The man, Mary observed, had likely just raided the eagle's nest. At Nava, the Newcombs told the San Gabriel travelers that Hosteen Claw was performing a night chant ceremony at a trading post 70 miles to the east. After a fitful night of sleep in rooms that had formerly housed chickens, the women climbed into Orville's trusty auto and headed back into the desert. Their destination was Quimpeto, now Quimbeto, and their mostly roadless route took them east again and skirted the northern end of Chaco Canyon. The four rooms of the Quimpeto trading post were packed with people sleeping wherever they could find a space. Mary slept under a bed already occupied by a nurse. At dawn, everyone trekked through heavy snow to find the ceremony. It was everything Mary had hoped for. We managed to reach the ceremony nearby where the dancers were to be seen through the whirling snow, while the fires blew out sideways. Out of this turmoil appeared Claw, calm and benign. He had been conducting the ceremony in the hogan. He joined us for a while, and I got a very strong impression of power from him. The next morning, the weather cleared, and while Mary and her San Gabriel compatriots were making their breakfast over a cook stove shared with several dozen other campers, Claw walked into the trading post. He sought out Mary and asked her if she was the one who had bought his sand-painting blanket at Gallup. During their first conversation, Mary asked Claw the meaning of the dance she had just seen. When he asked her why she wanted to know, she told him that she was interested in religion. Claw studied Mary for a moment, and then asked, "How deep is the sea?" Claw's question startled Mary, since her primary fear and fascination since childhood had been the ocean. In the trading post, Claw began to tell Mary children's stories and Navajo morality tales that gave no significant insight into Navajo ceremonies and religious beliefs. Mary, known for her impatience and lack of social graces, stopped Claw mid-tale and told him she wanted to hear the great stories. Thus began the relationship between the Yankee spinster Mary Cabot Wheelwright and the Navajo medicine man, Hosteen Claw. Mary returned to San Gabriel Ranch, but stayed only long enough to confirm the location of Claw's next ceremony, organize and pack up her gear, and with Orville as her driver, head back into Indian country. Mary would repeat this journey deep into the land of the Navajos by automobile and eventually on horseback dozens of times in the next few years. Hosting Claw's role in the social, religious, and daily life of the Diné was hardly summed up by his title of medicine man. As a Navajo shaman, Claw was priest, physician, historian, artist, and teacher, virtually a centralized source of Indian culture, a human library of primitive lore. Recognized as one of the preeminent ceremonial practitioners of his time, Claw's esoteric knowledge of complex Navajo rituals was acquired through decades of study with an older cacique. In his 50s, when he met Mary, Claw had memorized and mastered 4 complete ceremonies: Nightway, Hailway, Chiricahua Windway, Mountainway, each of which incorporated complex chants, sound paintings, prayers, and rituals that took days to perform. Claw also carried in his head the tribe's oral histories, myths, and symbols used in many more ceremonies. There was no elder held in higher esteem by the Diné than Hosteen Claw. His mother, Slim Woman, had survived the long walk to Bosque Redondo, and her father was the great Navajo chief, Narbona. In his lifetime, Claw had witnessed the escalation of U.S. government intervention in the life and culture of the Navajos and seen the incursions of meddling missionaries who sought to eradicate his people's heathen religious practices. Clough feared the Navajo way was facing extinction. By 1920, and his first meeting with the wealthy Bostonian, Mary Wheelwright, Clough had been told by the Great Spirit to document and preserve Navajo stories, rituals, and religious objects. Clough continued to pass along his knowledge to his understudy, but he also employed his remarkable skills as a weaver to permanently document the sacred sand paintings and designs carried in his head. Clough was a Nadli, a transformed man-woman deserving of special status and prestige among the Navajos. There is disagreement among his biographers as to whether Clough was born a hermaphrodite or emasculated as a child by the Utes. Whatever his biological and sexual orientation, Clough's career as a venerated medicine man and a master weaver enabled the preservation of valuable and sacred Navajo religious customs. There was a remarkable and nearly instantaneous connection between Clough and Mary, and their friendship seemed preordained in both their lives. Clough recognized that Mary's quest to understand Navajo religion was sincere, personal, and without ulterior motives. He also understood that she had the resources and the sensitivity to gather and preserve his people's stories and ceremonies, and that unlike Natalie's self-appointed task to record the music of Native America, begun 20 years before, Mary's collaboration with Clough to preserve the stories and rituals of the Diné became a consuming vocation that directed and engaged her intellect and passion for the rest of her life. Mary followed Clough to the farthest camps and gatherings in Navajo land. Because note-taking was forbidden in a ceremonial hogan, Mary's recording of Clough's rites and chants were done from memory after the ceremony. Frank Newcomb often accompanied Mary and would memorize the actual sand painting associated with a ritual, while Mary would memorize the myth, translated by Clough's apprentice, Baal, told in a ceremony. Over the next decade, using a recording machine when she and Clough worked privately, and relying on her memory when she attended a ceremony, Mary amassed a comprehensive collection of Navajo chants, myths, and ceremonies. Clough, Baal, and Mary met at the homes of traders, at schools, even in the underground sample room of the Gallup Harvey House. Clough and Baal also came to San Gabriel Ranch to work with Mary. In non-ceremonial recording sessions, Clough and Mary worked 2 3-hour sessions a day, or until Clough became weary. Mary always wrote her notes in longhand, because a typewriter interrupted Clough's flow, and she never asked questions during a session because Clough's stories were told in a kind of rhythm which should not be broken any more than necessary. In the 1920s, the only published materials about Navajo religion and ceremonies were by an army surgeon, Washington Matthews, who had lived at Fort Wingate in the 1890s. Matthews had gained the confidence of the Navajos under his care and had been invited to observe sacred dances and ceremonies. The surgeon kept diaries and records and published his experiences in articles and academic monographs about Navajo myths, legends, rituals, silverwork, sand paintings, and weavings before his death in 1905. Matthews's published studies became Mary's Bible on the subject of Navajo religion. San Gabriel Ranch was comfortable and private and provided Mary with everything she needed for long stays in New Mexico, including the wranglers and guides necessary for travel into the outback. Mary liked the San Gabriel cowboys and was stimulated by their relationship to my kind of woman, even as she found that being from Boston was a distinct handicap, and I was determined that one of my missions was to convince cowboys that it was possible for a person to be a good sport and also drink tea. In the southwestern outback, women were expected to shed the prissy helplessness acceptable back east and pull their own weight, whether on top of a horse or alongside it, through dust storms, thunder, lightning, pouring rain, pounding hail, burning heat, or howling snowstorms, at high noon or in the dead dark of night. Mary enjoyed being treated as a person who would be brave in an emergency, and the cowboy notion that she, like all women on the trail, was able to live up to a difficult situation. Just as she had overcome her fear of the sea and become a proficient sailor and navigator, Mary became a capable horsewoman and competent traveler of the high desert of Indian country. As Carol, Alice, and Natalie before her, Mary had to learn to ride astride a western saddle. By her third season in Alcalde, she was ready for a grand expedition through the outback. With her friend Evelyn Sears and with Jack Lambert, a father now, his daughter Louise a little more than a year old, as their guide, Mary departed Alcalde in late April 1923 for a pack trip that would cover 550 miles in 29 days and take her across the magnificent and brutal Rainbow Trail. Lambert had a natural, friendly way with city slickers like Mary, but he never pampered a dude or a dudette, no matter their age or experience. Even for someone used to a western saddle, the route called for long days on the trail, with stops few and far between. With Lambert's encouragement, dudes came to be secure on a horse and proficient around camp. Lambert taught his charges how to make biscuits in the Dutch oven, create a bed on the ground, and pass an evening staring contentedly into the fire or up at the stars. Kayenta was still the gateway to the last real frontier in the continental United States. In 1923, the half-dozen stone, wood, and mud buildings of John and Louisa Wetherall's trading post and home remained a virtually inaccessible outpost on the vast red and orange desert. There were still no roads north and west from Kayenta, and the trail from the Wetherills to Nonizoshi was no easier when Mary attempted it in 1923 than it had been for the expeditions of Roosevelt and Zane Grey a decade before. A journey to Rainbow Bridge was a lesson in improvisation and endurance. Whatever was useless or frivolous was left at the Wetherills. If Mary had read the harrowing accounts of previous travelers across the raw, scalded desert near Navajo Mountain, and the harsh landscape of the Rainbow Trail, she did not let it sway her resolve to see the legendary stone bridge. "No one who has not seen it can imagine the difficulties of the trail," Mary wrote, "where it was necessary for the horses to climb up the slick rocks or petrified sand dunes, and where we went afoot and the horses follow Ben Wetherall's horse as best they could. At times I felt I could not possibly get through. At one point the trail was so steep that I could only get up by holding on to the tail of my horse." The better-bred horses, Mary observed, like the better-blooded humans, were the ones that balked and lost their nerve in the most difficult stretches of the trail. Mary, however, defied her breeding, and with her guides Jack Lambert, Everett Cheatham, and Ben Wetherill, and with every one of their horses and pack mules, crossed the Rainbow Trail and reached Nonizoshi. She slept on the sand under the great stone arch in full moonlight, and like pilgrims before her, woke in the night and gazed into the canyon. The other sleepers lay calm and white in the starlight, Zane Grey wrote from his desert bedroll. There was something nameless in that canyon, and whether or not it was what the Indian embodied in the great Nonizoshi, the truth was that there was a spirit. On the morning of May 8, 1923, Mary, Evelyn Sears, Jack Lambert, and their companions signed their names in the registry kept in a metal box under the bridge. Mary was Pilgrim number 168. Mary did manage to convince the San Gabriel horse wranglers and auto guides that a person who drank tea could also be a good sport. Jack Lambert was perhaps Mary's first convert, and he, like all the San Gabriel staff, learned that although Mary may have looked the pampered maiden, she was in fact from a line of women who had traveled to the rough edges of the world, and none of them minded much being uncomfortable. Dorothy Kent went with Roy, Lambert, and Carol to Rainbow Bridge in the mid-1920s and insisted on taking along her violin. It was an awkward and certainly non-essential item, but Lambert secured Kent's instrument case to a horse, and the violin went with their expedition over the ridiculously difficult Rainbow Trail. If Carol and Kent recorded their names in the bridge log, the pages from their visit were lost. But Kent's was likely the first violin to reach the Sacred Arch, and she was surely the first graduate of the Juilliard School of Music to play classical music in the light of the full moon at Rainbow Bridge. In the autumn of 1923, while out riding with Carol through the golden-leafed cottonwoods of the Rio Grande Bosque, Mary saw the abandoned two-story adobe mansion with sagging wraparound porches called Los Luceros. Carolyn Roy had purchased the dilapidated house and the surrounding 138 acres of fields, orchards, and outbuildings on the east banks of the Rio Grande in January of that year. The Fathals were using the property to grow alfalfa and to pasture San Gabriel's horses, but they had no plans to rehabilitate the old hacienda. Mary wanted to see the interior and toured the house with Carol. Cattle had broken into the first floor and had wreaked havoc on doorways and floors, and portions of the 42-inch-thick adobe walls had been damaged by Rio Grande floodwaters. The once-manicured vegetable and flower gardens and the massive apple orchard were unrecognizable and overgrown. The property was in ruins, but Mary fell in love with Los Luceros on sight. Soon after that autumn ride, Carol and Roy sold Mary the circa 1840 two-story adobe dwelling and 6 acres of land along the banks of the Great River. Before Mary left New Mexico for the East, she placed Carol in charge of the renovation of the once elegant Luceros mansion. A local builder, Ted Peabody of Española, who had worked with the Fathals in the renovation of San Gabriel, became Carol's foreman and head carpenter for Los Luceros. Los Luceros was a classic, territorial-style adobe, although two-story dwellings of any kind were rare in northern New Mexico. But most of the renovations done in 1923 to 1924 reflected the popular Santa Fe style and used Spanish Pueblo Revival design elements. Mary told Carol she wanted New England touches like bay windows, built-in cabinets, bookshelves, and closets. Outside, Mary wanted flagstone walkways, unheard of in rural New Mexico, a duck pond, and a lawn of bluegrass and clover. The hacienda's exterior walls were whitewashed instead of stuccoed, and the window trim and doors were all painted a dark Yankee green. After more than a year of renovation, Los Luceros was a ranch worthy of a Boston Brahmin, and Mary called New Mexico home for at least part of each year. She was not the only woman creating a place of her own along the Rio Grande in the early 1920s. The Fathals sold off more of their property to the millionaire writer Marie Tudor Garland, who built the H&M Ranch with her husband, Henoir Rodakovich, renamed the White Swan Ranch after they divorced, alongside the Alcalde Plaza. By the mid-1920s, the dirt road that went north from Española past San Juan Pueblo into the Rio Grande Gorge and up to Taos and Mabel's Turf wound past the ranches of 4 new women, Dorothy Kent, Marie Garland, Carol Fathal, and Mary Wheelwright. In the fall of 1923, Elsie Clues Parsons joined the neighborhood of new women along the Rio Grande when she moved into one of Carol's guest cottages for the first of many prolonged stays at San Gabriel. Parsons was a notable addition to the Valley community, since she was among the world's most unconventional, prolific, and outspoken sociologists, anthropologists, and feminists. She was born in Grosvenor House at 10 Fifth Avenue in 1874, 1 year before her Greenwich Village neighbor, Natalie Curtis. Her father, Henry Clues, founded the New York banking firm that bore his name, and her mother, Lucy Madison Worthington, was a descendant of President James Madison. As a teenager, Elsie Clues rebelliously opted out of the debutante social life expected of the daughters of the very wealthy, and instead pursued an undergraduate degree at Barnard College, and eventually a master's and Ph.D. in sociology at Columbia. Even after marrying Herbert Parsons, a New York lawyer and Republican congressman, who was a close friend and political ally of Theodore Roosevelt, and after giving birth to 6 children, 4 of whom lived, the restless, inquisitive, and brilliant Mrs. Parson insisted on pursuing a life and career characterized by a strenuous revolt against convention. In the first decade of the 20th century, she focused her independent research on the problems of the modern family and on how, in her opinion, those problems were the result of the subordinate status of women. Parson's book, The Family, published in 1906, scandalously recommended the concept of trial marriage and proposed the popular feminist manifesto that women would only become fit wives and mothers when they were given the same opportunities for personal and professional development as men. The Family raised aristocratic eyebrows and ruffled the feathers of conformists and conservatives, and following its publication, Mrs. Parsons was dropped from the New York Social Register. Parson's personal and professional life was shaped by her passionate feminism, her dazzling intellect, and her fearless temperament. "Women try hard to live down to what is expected of them," she declared in 1913. In New York City, Parsons, like her neighbor Mabel Dodge, was a member of the Greenwich Village feminist discussion group, Heterodoxy, begun in 1912. She was also an erudite and vociferous participant in the lively discussions about sex, marriage, and the emancipation of women held weekly at Mabel Dodge's apartment near Washington Square. Before she came to the Southwest and began her studies of the cultures and people of Native America, Parsons published more than 75 academic papers and magazine articles, and 4 books that boldly challenged traditional American ideals regarding women's reproductive rights, the rights of children and adults in marriage, the burdens placed on women who married, and the domination of women by men. Discouraged by the slow progress of American cultural reform movements, especially the feminist movement, in 1916, Parsons turned her full attention to the Indian cultures of the American Southwest. It was a turning point in her life and in her career. In the fall of 1913, Parsons visited the New Mexico pueblos of Acomaw and Laguna, but it was her journey to Zuni Pueblo in 1915 that initiated her extended ethnological study of the Pueblo people. After the death of an infant and the discovery that her husband Herbert was having an extramarital affair, Parsons sought solace in New Mexico. The solitude of the land and the satisfaction she found in fieldwork gave the 41-year-old Parsons a personal and professional remedy for a midlife crisis. Between 1915 and 1917, Parsons escaped the social and physical confines of upper-class New York City in the wide-open spaces of New Mexico and Arizona, and conducted her research while living in a tent near a pueblo, or in a cave if she was working on the Pajarito Plateau. This cave room faced south. Parsons wrote of her cliff-hugging quarters at Puye, the same pueblo ruin where Alice camped with Hewitt in 1916. "And that night I looked out from its frame on the moonlit talus below, on the pines beyond, and thought that whether Indian or white, one was fortunate indeed to live for a time in a world of such beauty." Elsie Clues Parsons' father died in 1923, and with a hefty inheritance, the already liberated Parsons became an independently wealthy woman who could travel and live precisely as she liked. When she moved into the adobe casita at San Gabriel Ranch in November 1923, she had lived at Laguna, where she worked alongside Natalie's friend, Franz Boas, Acomaw, Zuni, and Jimez Pueblos. She had stayed with Mabel Dodge in Taos, and had also lived at Hopi First Mesa, and was an honorary member of one of the native families, often the sole woman on anthropological research trips into the outback. Parsons was breaking down the taboo that had long prevented academic camaraderie between men and women, and pushing back the social barrier that kept women barred from all fieldwork. She herself underwrote the research trips of her male and female colleagues, and in 1918 was instrumental in the formation of the Southwest Society, an organization that raised money and funded anthropological fieldwork. When she moved into San Gabriel, Parsons was 49 and a new grandmother, and although she was still the wife of Herbert Parsons, Elsie Clues came to San Gabriel Ranch with her lover of 5 years, the novelist Robert Herrick. From her home base in Alcalde, Parsons intended to study the culture and collect the folk stories of the Tewa people living along the Rio Grande at San Juan, Santa Clara, and San Ildefonso Pueblos. Parsons may have met Carol and Roy Faffel during previous visits to New Mexico, since their ranch was a popular lunch stop for automobile travelers on the road between Santa Fe and Taos. At San Gabriel Ranch, Parsons had access to the neighboring Tewa Pueblos, but she also had access to the Faffels, who by the 1920s had developed an extensive network of friends and confidants in the Tewa Pueblos and Hispanic villages of the Rio Grande and Chama River valleys. Although the Tewa Pueblos allowed formal visits by tourist groups and permitted limited access to their ceremonial dances, they were guarded and tight-lipped about their myths, social structure, and kinship patterns. Parsons needed Carol and Roy to personally open doors to their friends in northern New Mexico. "Imitating the secretiveness observed in all the Rio Grande Pueblos, I settled in Alcalde, the Mexican town 2 or 3 miles north of San Juan, Parsons wrote in the opening pages of her book about the Tewa. And here, thanks to my helpful and understanding hosts of San Gabriel Ranch, I secured informants from San Juan, Santa Clara, and San Ildefonso. November weather in New Mexico is pleasant and moderate, and Carol was pleased to have their ranch filled with guests almost until Christmas of 1923. Parsons and Herrick stayed from mid-November until mid-December. In letters to her husband, Parsons wrote of San Gabriel's proximity to the Seven Mountains and blue sky mostly. Although the food was delicious and her room was warm and quiet, Parsons pined for the utter solitude she had known in cliff-hugging caves and mesa-topped campsites, and complained about having to share the ranch with other guests. Nonetheless, San Gabriel suited her. A dude ranch indeed, and I stick to it. My informants are brought out from the Pueblo. Parsons would return to the adobe casita at San Gabriel until 1926, when she bought her own ranch several miles downriver near the Pueblo of Santa Clara. The residents of Santa Fe and the villagers of northern New Mexico were becoming accustomed to unconventional and unescorted white women moving through and often into their communities. But even among the expats, the tall, thin Parsons, with her chiseled face and intense, confident gaze, was remarkable. Like Natalie and Alice, once she set foot on New Mexico's soil, Parsons happily shed all semblance of her fashionable, high-society upbringing and donned the standard outback uniform of leather boots, wide-brimmed hat, and khaki. At a time when women were forbidden to smoke in public, Parsons defiantly wore her cigarette holder and lighter on a chain around her neck and declared that her greatest enjoyment was to have, at the same time, a cigarette, a cup of coffee, and an open fire. It is very hard to get all three together. It is easier among Indians than among ourselves. Parsons's reentry to life in New York City was reminiscent of Natalie's and was disconcerting for her and for her family. Parsons's mother found her just back from the desert daughter's appearance to be perfectly dreadful, even scandalous, in that she wore khaki clothes and an old felt hat, and she was touching up her hair, and of course it hadn't been touched up while she'd been away, so she wore a bandana tied around it, and then these saddlebags full of manuscripts. In New Mexico, Parsons and her dusty skirts, saddlebags stuffed with stenographer notebooks, and unkempt hair blended into the emerging community of like-minded women who embodied in greater and lesser proportions the evolving characteristics of 20th-century feminism. In Santa Fe and in the Spanish villages along the Rio Grande, Parsons joined Carol Stanley, Mary Wheelwright, Dorothy Kant, Marie Garland, Mabel Dodge Lujan, Alice Corbin, Elsie Shepley Sargent, Margretta Dietrich, and her sister Dorothy Stewart, and the sisters Amelia and Martha White, in the first wave of what would become a historic groundswell of single and married women who recreated their lives in northern New Mexico. In December 1925, following the accidental death of her husband, killed while demonstrating a motor-drive bicycle just given to his son Mac, Elsie Clues came to San Gabriel with her two youngest children, Mac, 14, and Herbert Jr., 16. Elsie was still involved with Herrick, with whom she would journey to Egypt and the Sudan in April, but he did not accompany Elsie Clues and her grieving children to New Mexico in 1925. The Christmas vacation gave Elsie a rare, long, uninterrupted holiday with her two sons. Although she did some field work at the nearby pueblos, her primary focus was the simple joys found in New Mexico during the holiday season and reconnecting with her own sense of purpose. "I ride horseback daily, and it has done me good," she wrote her daughter Lissa, who was married with a newborn baby. "Most of all, though, the interest in my old job has been restorative. The beauty of the country I have never succeeded in getting across to you or anyone who has not seen it for himself." Gunga Faffel's diary records the comings and goings of Dr. Parsons and her boys throughout the month they lived in the casita at San Gabriel. Mary Wheelwright was at Los Luceros for Christmas that year and came almost daily to San Gabriel to dine or play cards. Seven Up was a favorite. Ride horses, or go for walks with the Faffel's guests and extended family. Mother Lambert was at the ranch visiting her son Jack, his wife Lois, and their 3-year-old daughter Louise. Roy and Lois's sister, Marie Wolfe, and her husband also came for Christmas that year. Marie Garland, George King, Alice and Bill Henderson, Mabel Dodge and Tony, her colored friend, as Gaga referenced Mabel's husband, Tony Lujan, came with Spud Johnson, now living with Witter Binner in Natalie's former home in Santa Fe, for lunch and leisurely conversation around the San Gabriel dining room table just before New Year's. Roy and Orville Cox drove the Parsons family to Frijoles Canyon for day hikes, up the road above the Rio Grande to Taos, and northwest along the Chama River to Abiquiu. On Christmas Eve, Mary Wheelwright went with the Parsons family, Gaga, Roy, Mother Lambert, and the extended Lambert-Faffel family to watch the all-night dances at the nearby pueblos. Only Carol was missing from the holiday festivities. From early December until mid-January, she was at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota. She spent her 46th and Roy's 40th birthday in a bed in the Rochester Clinic and underwent surgery on December 22nd for a condition that Gaga did not specify or elaborate upon in her diary. 18. Roughneck and Lowbrow. Irony drives every good story about women's lives in the West. The best stories run like the braided streams of the region's great river system, liberally strewn with ironies and ambiguities. Virginia Scharf. San Gabriel was riding the economic high brought to the Southwest in the mid-1920s by the surge in American train and automobile travel. Dude ranches in northern New Mexico were suddenly the rage among savvy Easterners, and dudes reserved rooms at San Gabriel and other guest ranches in the West months before the season began in late March. After 6 years of hard work, the Faffel's guest ranch and outfitting business was operating at capacity and making real money. San Gabriel Ranch was the featured centerpiece of the Santa Fe Railway's promotion, America's most famous 50-mile square. The ranch was expensive and exclusive, and before a potential guest was granted a reservation, Carol's assistant, Minnesotan Margaret Phillips, who would marry a San Gabriel wrangler, Sandy McLean, looked up their credit report in Dun & Bradstreet. If someone was not favorably listed, they were not given a reservation at San Gabriel. Carol's guest roster included members of America's most influential families. Jack Lambert guided the family of the Santa Fe Railway executive, J. Sanford Otis, into the Four Corners, and Nicholas Roosevelt, now a seasoned writer with the New York Times, stayed at San Gabriel and went on at least one extended expedition into the outback with Carol's wranglers and equipment. Winfred Douglas stayed at San Gabriel every summer, and if one of his visits happened to coincide with Nick Roosevelt's, perhaps age and maturity had mellowed Roosevelt's adolescent dislike of the Episcopalian canon he had met at Walpi. From early May until late October, Roy, Jack, and the San Gabriel Cowboys, Sandy McLean, brothers Jack and Lester McKinley, and Pete Coleman, packed up and guided groups of between 2 and 12 individuals, male and female, adults and children, to Chaco Canyon, Canyon de Chelly, Mesa Verde, Hopi Land, the Grand Canyon, Monument Valley, Bryce and Zion Canyons, and the natural bridges of Utah. Orville Cox offered guests excursions through Indian Country and one of the ranch's touring cars, and at least once each season, Roy or Jack led a few intrepid guests to Kayenta, and with John Wetherill or Albert Smith, crossed the legendary trail to Rainbow Bridge. In late June 1925, Willa Cather and her companion Edith Lewis left the comforts of the Hotel La Fonda and the pleasant camaraderie of artists and writers found in old Santa Fe for the rural village experience of San Gabriel Ranch. Cather wrote Elsie Sargent, who was not in New Mexico that summer, how Alcalde was awfully hot. In spite of the June heat, Cather found the Faffel's ranch on the banks of the Great River to be exactly what she needed. Since her first journey to the Southwest, more than a decade before, Cather had loved hiking and riding in the desert and mountain outback, and sleeping in rustic, close-to-the-earth quarters. "I have a regular Zane Grey mind," Cather wrote. "Roughneck and Lowbrow is the name for me." Cather was reading the proofs of her new novel, The Professor's House, and within the San Gabriel Ranch community, She was in the company of individuals, Carolyn Roy, Mary Wheelwright, Dorothy Kent, Jack Lambert, Orville Cox, who had personal experience with the place, the canyon and cliff country of Mesa Verde, and the story, based in part on the Wetherills' discovery and excavation of the Mesa Verde, central to the professor's house. In Carol and her alcalde crowd were individuals whose lives had parallels to that of Cather's character, Tom Outland. Carol, Dorothy Kent, and Mary Wheelwright, among many others, had rejected the disillusionment, rigid structure, and materialism of modern life for the psychological space, spiritual freedom, and unconventional society of New Mexico. In late June, Tony and Mabel Dodge Lujan drove the 40 miles from Taos to Alcalde to retrieve Cather and Lewis, who spent the next 2 weeks at Los Gallos with Mabel and her other illustrious house guests, including D.H. and Frida Lawrence. Cather returned to Santa Fe in late July, and during that stay in the old capital, found and read the book, The Life of the Right Reverend Joseph P. Marchebeuf, that launched her research and writing of Death Comes for the Archbishop. The Bishop's Ranch, Bishop's Lodge in Tasuki, where Carol Roy and family had lived in 1918 and 1919, was the home of the first Archbishop of Santa Fe, Jean-Baptiste Lamy, who had attended seminary in France with Marchebeuf and built Santa Fe's Cathedral Basilica of St. Francis of Assisi. Cather based her character, Jean-Marie Latour, on Archbishop Lamy. The prosperity the Pfaffels had worked and hoped for had become a reality. In 1925, San Gabriel Ranch expanded to include a mountain retreat, El Rito Canyon Ranch, a homestead located in the high mountains between the villages of El Rito and Canjilon, New Mexico. By 1926, the renamed Canjilon Camp was a well-appointed haven with a grand main lodge and headquarters, half a dozen private log cabins, corrals of saddle and pack horses, a resident kitchen and housekeeping staff, and wranglers. Guests seeking the cool air and silence found at 8,000 feet above sea level could stay comfortably on the mountain for weeks at a time. San Gabriel's success enabled the Pfaffels to maintain the four-room apartment in Santa Fe on Canyon Road, and Carol and Roy enjoyed overnights in town. Carol also continued to come in alone for Indian Arts Fund board meetings and for solitary retreats from the guests, staff, and family of San Gabriel Ranch. On July 19th, Carol and Roy were among the guests at the gala bathing party that celebrated the opening of the White Sisters and Santa Fe's first swimming pool. Martha and Amelia Elizabeth White's home, El Delirio, The Madness, at 660 Garcia Street, had been transformed from a humble adobe casita surrounded by sage and cactus hills in 1923 into a sprawling estate designed by Alice Corbin's husband, William P. Henderson. Amelia White was a founding member of the Indian Arts Fund, for which Carol served a 6-year term as a trustee and executive committee member. Amelia, like her Bryn Mawr classmates, Elsie Sargent and Margareta Dietrich, had been an active participant in the defeat of the Burson Bill in 1922, and also joined Mary Austin and the Santa Fe Art Colony's vehement opposition to and defeat of the Southwest Federation of Women's Clubs' attempt, supported by Hewitt, to build a Chautauqua retreat in Santa Fe. The swimming party in July 1926 included nearly every member in good standing. Hewitt was not invited. Of Santa Fe's famous, forceful, and illustrious art, literary, and anthropology colony, as with most of the White Sisters' parties at El Delirio, there was a theme to the bathing party, and Carol and Roy, like all the guests, were expected to show up in costume. The theme for the July bash around the new swimming pool was a Mayan ceremony, and guests dressed in beaded and fringed skirts, moccasins, stick and feather headdresses, sandals, silver belts, bathing suits, and very little else. The poet, Widder Binner, wrote the script for the evening's main event, the ceremonial sacrifice at the sacred pool, and Alice Corbin directed the final act, the sacrificial pool dunking of the virgins, the title roles played by the two White Sisters. It was a time of gaiety, exuberance, and innocence, and Santa Feans enjoyed the ferment of the times without the lost feeling of the Paris group of American expatriates. The Roaring Twenties brought years of prosperity and happiness to the Pfaffels and their friends in northern New Mexico. But there was a shadow side to Carol's life that the San Gabriel staff and her closest friends were acutely aware of: Roy's gambling and drinking. By the late 1920s, the tension and discord created by Roy's addictions began to affect the people around him, and Carol's life and the community of San Gabriel Ranch began to unravel. The new year of 1927 began ominously with an automobile accident. Roy was driving Carol down the steep, snow-packed mountain road from Canjilon Camp when the Lincoln overturned, injuring Carol's leg and sending her to the hospital. In the first week of July, Mother Gaga, out on a picnic with Carol's secretary and a guest, nearly drowned in the swollen waters of the Rio Grande when the road gave way and their Chevrolet plunged 60 feet into the river. Gaga and her friends were saved, almost by a miracle, when two men from San Ildefonso Pueblo heard their cries and, after a Herculean effort, pulled each of the three from the rising waters with ropes and a team of horses. The car was sucked into quicksand and never seen again. A traumatized and hypothermic Gaga was taken to the hospital in Santa Fe, where she was treated for a broken nose and numerous bruises. Carol was not sleeping well and suffered migraine headaches throughout the summer. By late fall, Roy's gambling debts had dug so deeply into San Gabriel's funds that the Fathels were forced to enter into mortgage agreements with family and friends. Mary Wheelwright alone loaned San Gabriel $20,000. Even with a wife and small child at the ranch, Jack Lambert preferred to spend the dude season on horse expeditions of 4 to 6 weeks in Indian country. But by 1927, he could no longer ignore his brother-in-law's alcoholism. After a particularly challenging horse and auto journey to the Grand Canyon, with a doctor whose wife became violently ill after eating poisonous mushrooms, Lambert returned to Alcalde, found Roy was drinking, and decided it was time to sever his ties with San Gabriel Ranch. By season's end, Jack asked the Fathels for a letter of recommendation. 3 days before Carol and Roy's birthday in December, Roy reluctantly penned a statement to whom it may concern, recommending Jack as a pack and motor trip manager, adding that he regretted Mr. Lambert was leaving his employ. The end of their 10-year partnership was a bitter and painful ordeal for both Roy Fathel and Jack Lambert. For Lambert, who considered the ranch and the community on the Rio Grande his home, moving his wife and daughter out of the adobe Jack himself had built at San Gabriel was among the lowest moments of his life. "How I loved that place," Lambert said years later. "Losing it almost broke my heart." With wife Lois and daughter Louise, Jack moved into Santa Fe, where the Lamberts managed a little restaurant opened by the White Sisters in Sena Plaza. But the Lambert marriage was in trouble, and by 1929 Jack and Lois were divorced. Jack went looking for ranch work in Arizona. Lois and 7-year-old Louise went east and lived in Tarrytown near or with Dorothy Kent and Canon Douglas and his wife, Dr. Joe, while Louise attended the junior St. Mary's School in Peekskill. Jack Lambert returned to New Mexico and worked as the manager of the White Sisters El Delirio. Although he was married 5 times, Lambert had only 1 child, Louise. His 5th and final wife was Marjorie Ferguson, a Hewitt-trained archaeologist and the curator at the Museum of New Mexico for over 30 years. Lambert and Ferguson married in 1950, and they lived the next 41 years on Garcia Street in Santa Fe until Lambert's death in 1991. The winds of unrest swirled like dust devils through the once peaceful gardens and grounds of San Gabriel Ranch. During an autumn visit in the late 1920s, Hosteen Claw pulled ranch wrangler Sandy McLean aside and said, "Tell my friend Carol that her man is hurt." Around San Gabriel and Alcalde, Claw's psychic abilities were widely respected, and Gaga, Carol, and the ranch staff waited nervously for Roy to return from Santa Fe. Within a few hours of Claw's ominous statement, Roy had not returned, and Carol learned that his horse had lost its footing in the rodeo parade and fallen, injuring Roy. Carol kept meticulous account books for San Gabriel and knew there was absolutely no disposable income, but Roy continued to gamble, and his nights at the poker tables of northern New Mexico fueled Carol's migraines and escalating sense of doom. However, in 1928, Roy participated in a card game that would change Carol's life and offer her, paradoxically, one last chance to make a permanent home in the Southwest. The actual where and when of the poker game is the stuff of myth and legend. Somewhere in Rio Arriba County, perhaps in a village bar, a ranch barn, or at a kitchen table, or maybe out under the stars by a campfire at some cow camp, Roy Pfaffel and at least one member of the Alfredo Salazar family played a high-stakes game of cards. What Roy Pfaffel wagered in that game can only be speculated upon. As of late December 1927, San Gabriel Ranch was incorporated with shareholders and was heavily mortgaged. The Pfaffel still owned Canjilon Camp and approximately 600 acres in the mountains above El Rito, but it is unlikely Roy could have staked the land without Carol's consent and co-signature. Roy may have held title to one or more of the San Gabriel Lincolns and to its horses, saddles, and expedition equipment. But in the winter of 1928, Roy Pfaffel had little to nothing to lose in a poker game. The Salazars were sheep ranchers who had lived for generations on the high desert of the Piedra Lumbre, Shining Stone Basin, below Cerro Piranal, 10 miles north of Abiquiú. The family had extensive landholdings in Rio Arriba County that included an abandoned and reputedly haunted homestead at the mouth of Yeso, Gypsum Canyon, under the spectacular cliffs on the northern edge of the Piedra Lumbre Basin, called El Rancho de los Brujos, Ranch of the Witches, by the locals. The Rito del Yeso homestead consisted of one dilapidated jacal, cedar post and mud dwelling, a few corrals and sheds, and the homestead's most valuable asset, a perennial source of water. Roy had visited the haunted homestead under the great cliffs north of Abiquiú many times. He watered horses at the stream and used the corrals for San Gabriel expeditions en route to Navajo land to the northwest and Mesa Verde to the north. There was also access to the mountains and to Canjilon Camp via a narrow, rocky horse and mule trail that climbed up and out of a box canyon where the waters of the Yeso stream literally oozed from sheer rock walls. By 1928, no one had lived in the spirit-infested landscape of the Rito del Yeso homestead for nearly 30 years. The Salazar family may have been looking to rid themselves of the place and purposefully lost the deed to the gringo Roy Pfaffel in the fabled poker game. Ghosts and witches were not taken lightly in northern New Mexico, and local residents had kept clear of the ranch of the witches since the late 1800s, when the homestead had been the hideout for a mean bunch of cattle rustlers led by the notorious Archuleta brothers. From the 1880s until the mid-1890s, cattle stolen by the Archuleta gang was held in Yeso Canyon. Any rancher unlucky enough to stumble upon the Archuleta's operation was never seen again. An undetermined number of bodies were believed buried in the red and gold sands under the cliffs, but the saddles, firearms, and horses of the murdered could be counted among the possessions of the Archuletas. The Archuleta's reign of terror ended in the 1890s when one brother murdered the other during an argument concerning a gold payment. The remaining Archuleta was either hung by a sheriff's posse or run out of town by the local ranchers. By 1900, the ghosts of those murdered by the cattle rustlers created such an incessant racket in the canyons and sandhills of the northern edge of the Piedra Lumbre that not even seasoned shepherds and cowboys from the nearby communities of Abiquiú, Coyote, Cañones, or Youngsville would stay a night at the place. Only a gringo outsider would be foolish enough to want El Rancho de los Brujos. Roy won the deed to HES 127, the 157-acre homestead at the Ranch of the Witches, in the early spring of 1928. In her account ledger, Carol recorded that the place she called Ghost Ranch, valued at $6,000, was acquired that year. It took the Salazar family 10 or 12 months to legally sign over the deed, but in February 1929, the place of Ghost Ranch was recorded in the Rio Arriba County records to be the property of one Caroline S. Pfaffel. Roy was not mentioned on the deed. Even before the stock market crash in October 1929, San Gabriel Ranch was in a death spiral. Mary Wheelwright, Marie Garland, and Florence DeBell Bartlett had loaned the Pfaffels substantial amounts of money, hoping to keep the ranch and the local economy it supported afloat. The walls of the guest ranch flanked the Alcalde Village Church and Plaza, and San Gabriel generated jobs and brought cash into the rural community. Because it was on the main road to Taos from Santa Fe and all points south, San Gabriel's dining room had become a popular meal stop for auto travelers. San Gabriel Ranch had essentially put Alcalde on the map. But after Lambert departed as manager, and Roy's addictions became impossible to ignore, the ranch's neighborhood support faltered. Bartlett purchased the land that her house El Mirador was built on. She had leased the property throughout the 1990s.